This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We call our show Main Street because these microphones are our virtual Main Street right across North Dakota this time of day. And this is where we share our news and opinions, as you do when you cross your own Main Streets and meet your friends and acquaintances. And today we've got an old friend of Main Street with us because it's, of course, a growing season day, a beautiful May day. And that's Ron Smith, Main Street's horticulturist, is in to bring us up to date on what we can do right now. And Ashley Thornburg is with us as well.
And Ron, what should we be doing right now? It's nice enough to be outside all the time.
It is. It's absolutely beautiful. And of course, you get out there and you want to do some more trimming. You want to do things that are going to be making your lawn look good. Now is a good time to go ahead and fertilize your lawn because the grass is actively growing. And that fertilizer you put down will take up the nutrients and grow lushly and thickly for you. So you get lots of exercise going out there and mowing it. The other thing that is perfect for, the lilacs are just starting to come into bloom, at least in the Fargo-Moorhead area here. And so that would be a good time to go ahead and put down pre-emergent herbicides to control the annual weeds that you'd have in your established landscape beds where you have woody plants, also in your lawn.
Why would you use lilacs as the indicator? Is it just because of the timing?
The soil is warm enough, the environment's warm enough that's going to get the weed seeds to begin germination, and so that's the time you want to catch them, just as they're starting to break dormancy and start to germinate and crowd your lawn up or your garden bed up with all these nice little obnoxious annual weeds. And the other final thing is the dandelions that's showing up, okay? Dandelions are certainly very beautiful little weeds. Someday mankind's going to discover that this is this will be the cure for everything that's wrong with the human race and give up trying to kill a dog on stuff. And then when we really need it, that's probably when it's going to die out from something. I don't know what. But
you should write a novel. That sounds really uplifting.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting weed. It's persistent. You can go ahead and kill it. A lot of people like to put the herbicide down, the broadleaf herbicide down now when they see the flowers. It's easy to spot in the lawn or in the garden. And they love the revenge that they get when they see the flower curl up and the leaves curl up like it's being slowly strangled. They've got it. But that really doesn't kill it unless it's just a seedling that's just coming up this spring. Usually it's some other plants that are showing off that have been around for a couple of years. And if you do that, you might slow her down a little bit, but then she'll be back this fall. And the fall is actually the best time to control your dandelions. And I don't say go out and put a flag by each dandelion that you see for getting it next fall, but that's really the best time to go ahead and control it.
Can I ask a really dumb question here about dandelions? They've been around for forever. They have this very bright, beautiful yellow flower. Mm-hmm. Why has nobody tried to hybridize a dandelion into a beautiful annual?
I don't know. I don't have an answer. That's not a dumb question. That's a very good one. You know, we're all interested in DNA and genetics coming up, you know, in science these days. It's a very, very strong area. Why haven't we scientists, people out there that like to study this stuff, gone into the dandelion and said, what makes you so tough? What makes you so persistent? What can we learn from you?
Yeah, you can grow on the north side of my house.
Yeah, they grow everywhere, you know, in the cracks in the sidewalk. So those are the basic things that you need to be on the lookout for.
All right. Well, let's go to an email question here. This one is about an old maple tree or trees. Some of the huge old maple trees in our yard are not flowering. However, those trees that are not flowering are producing seeds in great abundance on the branches. I don't see the hanging yellow male and female panicles, but they started out with red buds that grew into clumps of seeds. What is this about?
Well, if she's getting seeds, she had flowers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can't have one without the other. But usually, if you get an overabundance of the seeds showing up, and that's what she's noticing, is that this is many times an indication that the tree is beginning, or the trees are beginning to get into sharp decline. And I would encourage this person to go ahead and contact an arborist and see if they can be checked. They can come out and check out the trees as to what's going on with them. That might be something that can be corrected. Or it just needs a fertilization or whatever it might be. She can also go to a website called Trees Are Good, www.treesaregood, all one word, .com, and to find tree services. And if she puts that down, she'll find a listing of the arborists in her area that she can go ahead and possibly contact and have somebody come out and take a look at those things.
I love that name, treesaregood.com. Another email question, also about a tree. Someone planted a bare root Ohio buckeye tree last spring. It seemed to grow fine until the fall. It grew about a foot before the leaves fell off for the winter, and then this spring now no leaves have come out.
You know, it would be wonderful and would take a lot of stress and concern away from gardeners and tree lovers if everything started like a sprint. Shotgun or a gun goes off, bing, on your mark, get, set, go, and all the leaves started to come out on the trees uniformly at the same time. But buckeyes are one of the slower trees to break bud in the spring. And so I would say be patient a little bit. If everything went well last year and she planted it bare root, that's a good way to go ahead and plant it because it has a better chance of getting established as a bare root tree than it does as a potted or bald and burlap tree. And unless something drastic happened to it over the winter months, like extremely low temperatures or rodent damage or something like that, the plant should break bud for her and produce leaves. Just be a little bit more patient. So,
Ron, if you were selling trees, what would be the selling point for a buckeye?
Well, I can think of one very conspicuous one. The buckeye is the state
of Ohio State. Yes, we know where you came from.
I know. I'm sorry. I had to get that plug in. But actually, the common buckeye is nothing to write home about. You might get that and say, oh, this weedy thing, it drops these nuts and the squirrels go crazy over it and it's a terrible-looking tree. But they do have new cultivars out that were developed by South Dakota State University and North Dakota State University. And they're beautiful trees. They're absolutely beautiful. They have good fall color. They've been bred or researched for good fall color. So I would encourage people to go to local nurseries and garden centers and look at the new cultivars that they have out there for you to go ahead and use in your yard. They don't get too big. And make sure you get a buckeye. They aren't going to sell horse chestnuts there. I know I could feel that question coming up. Horse chestnuts are in the same genus as a buckeye is, but they're two different trees. Buckeye is a smaller cousin to the horse chestnut, and no garden center is going to be selling just common buckeyes. So they're all going to be selling the cultivars.
We have another email question. We recently retired in the Jamestown area and acquired 4 horses, planning a vegetable garden, and would like to use horse manure as a fertilizer. Is it safe to use? How should I go about doing it? How long do I let the manure decompose? Do you need to compost it with other things?
Well, the best thing to do is let it sit for a year in a compost pile, and that'll get the weed seeds that are in there to go ahead and germinate or be cooked from the composting heat. And then go ahead and spread it next spring. If it's a year old already, it's safe to go ahead and spread. But for heaven's sakes, don't spread fresh horse manure. It stinks too much, number one. Number two, you're going to have a lot of weed seeds coming up. And there's nothing like going up to a manure pile, either a cow or a horse manure pile, and seeing all these wonderful weeds that the horses and the cows have eaten coming up in that pile. So you want to get that over with, and basically it should be okay to go ahead and use as a mulch or as an incorporator into your garden soil. It should provide good nutrients there for you. And besides, it gets rid of the ammonia salts that the leaching from the rains that you'd get in your local environment would get rid of the ammonia salts from the urine there that would otherwise be damaging to the plants.
And I wonder, is fertilizer a 20th century invention after manure?
Yeah.
The things you learn
when
you talk about horticulture with a horticulturist. Ron Smith comes in regularly during the growing season. If you have a question for him,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
Coming up next on Main Street, an intriguing initiative to document artistic works.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Little Shop of Horrors. It's campy. It's toe-tappy. It's everything we love in those 1950s monster movies. And served up with music. It's about a nerdy florist who finds his chance for success and romance with the help of a giant man-eating plant. Presented by the Fire Hall Theater and Home of Economy, Little Shop of Horrors is a scream. Opening May 11th, running through May 26th with a special late-night sing-along show May 20th. Tickets are available at 701-777-4090.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Take a stroll down Main Streets in Fargo or Bismarck or Minot or Jamestown, and you're likely to pass an art gallery. There are more galleries than before, and more homeowners are buying original works of art to put on their walls. More art means more interest in the artist and the provenance of the artwork. And for Ryan Mayberry, it was a business opportunity. Mayberry is the founder and owner of Art Noir, a process to document and identify art using a globally unique ID number. He's John Harris's guest this week on Prairie Pulse, which airs Friday evening on our television service.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you interested in something like this?
I've got a passion for software and internet and been building internet-based businesses my whole life, but I grew up in the art world. My father started his first art gallery in the 1970s. My first jobs was washing coffee cups at, you know, the gallery on Saturday afternoons. And, you know, as that family business grew and got bigger and more people got involved, they had more needs for software and technology and things like that. The art world's always been unique from a technology standpoint, often ignored, but I grew up with that natural passion about art, but a sort of my own passion and interest in software development. And Art Noir really just evolved for me looking at the industry and how it worked and how it functioned from a logistical standpoint more than anything. A lot of experience in other industries, transportation and pharmaceuticals and government regulatory type software, and it always sort of blew my mind that artists lacked a lot of technology, that we had the ability to track a package around the world from sitting on a shelf here and went into this box and onto this crate and into this ship and then across the world and all the way to somebody's door. But the works of art that we build our history and our culture upon and the stories and the information about those types of items are lost. They're shared by word of mouth and they're rarely written down and they're certainly not recorded in a fashion that can be preserved for, you know, long periods of time.
So why is it important for artists to document and control their art in the lifespan of an artist?
Artwork has a life on its own. One of the interesting things about it is nobody throws away a painting. It gets gifted or shared with somebody else or it gets resold. And when those things happen, certain processes take place. Artwork needs to be appraised. It needs to be insured. It needs to be a part of estate planning. So things like prices and authenticity come into factor. That's one of the services that, you know, the family business has a long history in providing is authenticating work. And when we go through the process of authenticating, we have to find out information. Who created it? When they created it? What year? Where? Why? What's it built on? You know, and that type of information becomes guesswork. Even in today's day and age, we hop on the internet, we start searching for information about art, and there's really very little to find. And unless your name is Picasso or Warhol and you have an institution built around you, the information is maybe somewhere, but who knows where? It's very important for artists to kind of be a part of that process because right now they're left out of it. When they create a work of art and it leaves their studio, they start to be disconnected from it. It goes from one person to the next person. Maybe it's exhibited here and published there and hung on a wall here and then moved over there. But, you know, the artist is back in their studio working on the next creation. And the history about that painting becomes a little bit like that telephone game you play in school where, you know, you whisper something down the line and it, you know, by the time it gets to the end, it's different, right? Mm-hmm. So a painting that was, you know, painted in a specific city for a specific reason at a specific time and date that arrived from, you know, certain inspirations and, you know, was maybe a pivotal time in that artist's life. The story of that painting gets whittled down to, well, this hung in my uncle's living room for 25 years and I always liked it, so he gave it to me. Mm-hmm. People get a lot of purpose out of their experience and exposure to art. And, you know, to me it seemed like such a shame that those stories kind of got lost in the process. Even the artists that are extremely regionally important, and most artists are not internationally famous, but they're regionally important. They affect their city and their town and their, you know, their state or their province. And those are the artists whose stories really, really matter. They're virtually nowhere to be found. But we have the technology to capture those stories. It's really just a matter of putting it in the hands of the artists so that they can make use of it.
Yeah, with that said, are you helping any artist could be involved with you, or are you working mostly with regional artists in Manitoba?
Any artist, really. We haven't targeted a specific region. We're a little heavy in Canada, the United States, because we're, you know, geographically we're located here. But we've got artists from right around the world that are using our system, and we're in the process of constantly providing other languages for people to use our system in. So most of our work has been translated into 8 different languages. The problem is a global problem. It's not isolated to North America. Artists all over the world have, you know, run into the exact same issues.
Well, I understand documenting street art and public art is maybe a passion of yours, or mm-hmm. something you're doing. Can you tell us about that?
Street art's kind of a bit of a phenomenon, especially over the last number of years. The rise of the internet and things like Instagram and that has given certain street artists the ability to expand their reach and expose themselves to a wider audience. But it's also a very fleeting work of art. It exists at a specific point in time. So one of the things that we do in our documentation is we geocache our information. So we don't just capture the title and the date and sort of the, you know, who created the work of art, but we capture physically the latitude and longitude of where it exists and how long it existed there. So this has proven very effective for documenting street art and street art festivals, and it, you know, it's sort of a unique way to capture even just an area or public art project, to see how art in a certain region or a very specific location has evolved over time.
Interesting. So what is the Art Pause Project?
Yeah, Art Pause Project is a fun little project that we started with Pattison Media in Canada. So we have been filling their empty billboards across the country with works of art. And it's an opportunity for the regular commuter to be exposed a little bit to art in an environment that they maybe weren't expecting it. In the wintertime, you spend a lot of time sort of, you know, sitting in your car, and you're inundated every day with billboards and advertisements and things like that. And people don't often get the time to go into a gallery or go into a museum. So we saw this opportunity to fill empty billboard spaces with big works of art, provide a little bit of exposure to people to, you know, something that they might just brighten their day.
Well, speaking of that, do you work in cooperation or partnership at all with other galleries, or like Winnipeg Art Gallery, anything?
We've got a tremendous amount of support from institutions right across the country. The Winnipeg Art Gallery worked closely with us on helping us to define, you know, the needs of artists. And the, you know, the needs of how people use information in art varies in the different types, parts of the industry. So the institutions have specific needs of what they document around work of art. And appraisers and insurance providers have their own needs. And, you know, gallery owners have their needs. Artists have their needs. So we've been trying to involve everybody in the industry in the process of, you know, what needs to be documented and how it needs to be documented. You know, been reaching out to a lot of, you know, artist-based organizations right across the country as well.
Sure. Let's go back. Tell me a little bit more about your technology background.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in a day and age where computers were just kind of breaking in. And I taught myself how to program when I was a little kid. People might remember Mad Magazine. Back in the 80s, in the middle of Mad Magazine, there was several lines of computer code. And if you typed that into your computer, it did something funny. So I used to type that in, and I'd change it a little bit here and there, and it would, you know, do something else funny. And, you know, one thing, you know, kind of led to another, and I was actually studying theater and film to produce TVs and TV shows and movies and things like that. And then the internet was invented, and I started selling email addresses door to door, and, you know, one thing led to another, and, you know, I started building software for artists. So,
yeah. So what's been the reaction thus far among the artists that you're working with?
It's been tremendous. Artists are very well aware of the issues, the problems that they face, but they're not very attuned to what those solutions might be, or how to, you know, how to start managing their provenance and their larger body of work. A lot of artists told us that, you know, finding Art Moi has been a bit of a breath of fresh air. It's an opportunity for them to start taking control of their work, asserting their copyright and ownership over the items that they create, and at least starting the process of being able to track and see how their artwork is used throughout its lifetime.
Hmm. So what kind of exposure do the artists get in working with you?
You know, Art Moi is inherently a closed system. So we don't try to govern how an artist needs to expose their work or where they need to expose it. But what we do is we give them the means to work in any type of environment that they want. So an artist can start the process of working in Art Moi, and then from there they can publish to their own website or publish to a gallery's website or to Facebook and Instagram and social media. And then we're constantly working on making sure that Art Moi communicates with all the other technology platforms that are out there. So we don't try to be a marketplace ourselves, but we try to be the conduit that feeds information into all the variety of art marketplaces that there are.
Yeah. Can you tell us about some of the artists that you work with?
We work with a lot of historical Canadian artists. We're working on a project to document the works of an artist named Maud Lewis, who's a famous Canadian folk artist. We're working on documenting the body of work of an artist named Walter J. Phillips that was heavily influential in the prairie regions as well as out in the West Coast. You know, we're broaching into some international markets now, working with a lot of up-and-coming contemporary artists that operating at sort of the higher gallery museum levels as well.
You know, you hit on this a little bit, but there are instances, I assume, where artists do not control their art. And of course, that's what your organization tries to help with. So why is it so important? Talk about that again.
It has a lot to do with this sort of the secondary art market. A lot of people are familiar with this concept of the starving artist, where, you know, the artist lives in poverty and their works of art go on to achieve, you know, huge value. The perception there is that, you know, the value exists in another part of the market. And that, while that might be true, the reason why that value exists is I believe that it's that secondary market that controls the information about art. So when artwork needs to be appraised, when it needs to be valued, when it needs to be authenticated, it's rarely the artist that actually does it. It's this secondary market that does it. And to me, that's because the secondary market is who generates the information about artwork. Interesting fact about, you know, the art world, vast majority is made up of galleries. Vast majority of galleries, over 80% of galleries worldwide, not just in North America, are single owner operations with no employees. So the art world in itself is controlled by individuals who don't have access to technology or not investing thousands and thousands of dollars into ways to share information and bring everybody that's sort of involved to the table. Usually when you're researching artwork, you hit a dead end far before you get to the artist. Art Moi allows artists to be brought to the table, to be included in that process, and be that main source of authoritative information about their artwork. The value in Art Moi is 50 years down the road.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Prairie Public's John Harris talking with Ryan Mayberry, owner of Art Moi in Winnipeg. You can find out more at Art Moi, that's ARTMOI.com, and you can see the entire Prairie Pulse television show this Friday evening at 7:30 Central. Well, coming up on Main Street, we'll stay with the art theme, talking with the author of the book, How Art Can Make You Happy, and of course, Dakota Date book. But right now, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota House and Senate Republicans have wrapped up their budget bills and are ready to start negotiations with DFL Governor Mark Dayton. There are big differences over spending and tax cuts, but Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says he's ready to talk.
Some of the bills, there's bigger challenges for the governor, and so we have to communicate why we want to do it, and he will push back, and we'll move forward in that process. But certainly some of them, the divide is much greater. I want to look at the ones that we're closer with now and try to get them over the hump and then work on those other ones as we keep moving forward.
Gazelka says he wants an agreement first on a transportation bill. He says agreements on a tax bill and on a health and human services bill will take more time. A Minnesota state lawmaker who pushed for online privacy protections this session says he's shocked the provision was left out of a compromise budget bill. DFL Senator Ron Latz of St. Louis Park says his measure prohibits internet providers from collecting customer personal data without permission. Latz says it's a response to Congress loosening online privacy regulations.
The response that I've gotten on this issue from people that have contacted me or see me, they bring up the topic voluntarily. We touched a nerve. And I think it would be a mistake for the legislature to ignore that.
Republican David Osmek of Mound was the only senator to vote against the provision. He says it needed more work.
We do want to have data privacy in Minnesota, but we need to do it the right way. And rushing it through at the last minute is the wrong thing to do.
Osmek says House and Senate negotiators are still working on the issue, but he says agreement might not come until next session. And a spring blizzard that dumped as much as 2 feet of snow over the weekend may have destroyed much of this year's wheat crop in western Kansas. From Harvest Public Media, Brian Thompson reports.
The heavy snow and cold temperatures delivered a 1-2 punch to a crop that had been looking pretty good. Rick Horton has 3,000 to 4,000 acres of wheat in southwest Kansas.
I would say it's like 80% gone, but until we get the snow off and see whether any of it's going to come back up, that's not a for sure deal. But right now, it looks really bad.
Experts say it may take about a week to know the full extent of the damage. A storm this late in the season raises concerns of both freezing and stem breakage. Kansas farmers grew about 1 in every 5 bushels of U.S. wheat last year. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Thompson.
Brian Thompson is a reporter for the Kansas News Service, a collaboration covering health, education, and politics across the state. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bridget Watson Payne is a San Francisco-based author. She's edited books about art. She blogs about art because she loves art and thinks you should, too. Her new book is titled How Art Can Make You Happy, and it's been published by Chronicle Books. It knocks down the notion of art as something intimidating. The book invites readers to look at art as it explores the human condition through the creativity of others. Recently, she spoke with Main Street's Eric Dethridge.
Bridget Watson Payne, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure. So why does thinking about art make some of us feel guilty?
You know, it's a funny thing. It's actually why I wrote this book. I would have a lot of conversations with people, and I realized how much guilt and anxiety folks were having around the subject of art. There's a number of different reasons. Sometimes people feel that they ought to be looking at art in a certain way, but they are not. A lot of this comes from, you know, big museum exhibitions that might come to town, and you mean to make it to that event. You keep thinking you will, but you don't get around to it. And then the show closes, and then you feel guilty that you never made it to that show. Other people wanted to start going to art galleries, but felt very intimidated by, you know, the what they perceived as kind of a scene that was happening there, and, you know, almost social anxiety more than anything else. There's a lot of different things that can go into it.
Right. And of course, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, instead of art creating anxiety, if we can experience art in a way that is beneficial to us, describe how that benefits us in a physical sense.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mention the physical aspect of it, because one of the things I say in the book is that art is magical. And a funny thing was that when I set out to prove that, I found that one of the best ways to sort of point up what I'm thinking of as quote-unquote magic is actually to look at science. And a lot of really interesting science has been done about what happens to people when they look at art. For instance, they've hooked people up to EKGs and, you know, see what goes on in the brain when you look at art. And art stimulates a lot of different parts of the brain, but the one that fascinated me the most was that actually, when you look at art, it stimulates the motor cortex, which is the part of your brain that controls the body and movement. So it is not a metaphor. It is a literal truth to say that when you look at art, you're not just experiencing it with your eyes or your brain. You are experiencing it physically in your body.
And medically, I think it reduces stress, of course. I think that's pretty obvious. But also, there have been some studies that it helps surgical wounds heal faster. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. So they did studies where they put patients who were healing after surgery in hospital rooms that had no art, hospital rooms that had various kinds of art, and they found that looking at landscape painting in particular, and even more specifically, seascapes, really improved the healing time that people experienced.
What about seascapes?
Because it was a scientific study, they did not go into the reasons of why seascapes in particular might, I don't think they were willing to speculate on why that might be, but that was the data that they found.
Well, it means there could be something beneficial to go in to some cheesy beachside motel with the cheesy seascape art on
I know, it does make you wonder, you know, what quality of seascapes is necessary for this to work.
No doubt. Well, Bridget, you say in the book that art wakes us up to three profound realities. What are they?
They are the reality of the world, the reality of other people, and the reality of ourselves. I can explain a bit about what each of those means. So the reality of the world, I think, on some level, we all know that the world that we live in is this astonishing place. Beauty abounds around us all the time. But for practical reasons, reasons of survival that, you know, in our ancestral days, and nowadays just reasons of sensory overload often, we have to tune out much of what's going on around us much of the time. If we didn't, we wouldn't be able to function. But when we tune out a lot of, you know, sort of random information that's not important to us, we also can frequently end up tuning out the beauty of what's around us. Mm. And art, we can kind of use art and artists as guides to help us get back to the wonder of the world. Because when you're looking at a piece of art, you're seeing how that artist saw the world. Even if the art is not representational, even if it doesn't actually look literally like the physical world, you're still getting insight into how that artist uniquely saw and thought about things, and that helps you get back to your unique vision. In terms of waking you up to the reality of other people, another thing that I often think about art is that it's really kind of the ultimate engine of empathy. Oh. We're all self-centered, again, sort of necessity. We kind of have to be. It's very hard for us to really deeply internalize and believe that other people are just as real as we are and are the center of their universes in the same way that we are the center of our universe. And art is a huge way to help us to do that, because the people who made this art were real. The people depicted in the art, if any, were real. Other people who have seen this same art and been moved by it and had experience of it were just as real as we are, and it reminds us of that. Third is the reality of ourselves. Now, if I just finish saying that we're all terribly self-centered, you might think, well, do we really need any more reminders of the reality and importance of ourselves? But of course we do, because we're all so busy and overwhelmed so much of the time, you know, running around with a million practical thoughts in our mind, sort of a hamster wheel in our brains, like thinking about that we've got to do this and do that and our jobs and get to the store, et cetera, et cetera. And art can really shake us up and get us out of that day-to-day chatter in our heads and wake us up to a more profound level of thoughts, feelings, emotions, pleasure, and really being alive.
Yeah, you do say that artists are the curators to our stimuli, and, you know, it's so overwhelming to take everything in. Speaking of that, overstimulation, how should we approach walking into an art museum with just all this beauty on the walls? How should we take that in, and what should we take walking out of the museum?
It is a little bit like all the art in the museum is, you know, clamoring for your attention. You know, look at me. But one thing I recommend, if possible, and this is, you know, sometimes more practical than others, but if you have a local museum, to visit it regularly. One way of doing that, of course, is to get a museum membership. If that is cost prohibitive, most museums have free days or free evenings or reduced price tickets. You know, there are usually some options for accessibility for getting in there on a somewhat regular basis. And I actually suggest, if you know you're going to be back, if you know you're going to go to someplace more than once, just go to a few rooms to start with. Don't try and get around to the whole museum. You know, pick a couple of galleries almost at random and spend some time in each one, slowly moving around the space, trying to spend at least a minute, like a full 60 seconds, standing in front of each piece of art and looking at it, and not trying to, you know, have too many profound thoughts or figure it all out. Just let it go in through your eyeballs and see how it makes you feel. And then go on to the next. And then if you come back several times, you can do that, you know, throughout the museum and slowly experience and start to figure out what you like.
Right. And you talked about, certainly, Bridget, artists being our guides, but you also mentioned that we should learn to become our own tastemakers. How do we do that?
Yeah, I really am a big believer in liking what you like, trusting your instincts, trusting the response, both the physical and the emotional response that you get off of art. Frequently, again, going back to the body, the metaphors we use to describe how art makes us feel can be physical. People will say something gave them chills, or it made their jaw drop, or, you know, it like seared into their eyeballs. You know, there's sort of all of this bodily stuff. We know how it feels to like something. The ultimate analogy is, we know how it feels to like a boy or a girl, to like them. You know, that's liking, and we all know exactly what that feels like. And when we allow ourselves to like a piece of art and not feel like, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to like this, maybe this isn't the best taste, maybe some art journalist somewhere would disagree with me liking this, we start to second guess our gut instincts. And I think getting back to the emotional quality that art produces in people, you know, the things that really make you feel strongly, and they may not make you feel pleasure and joy. When I say art is going to make you happy, I don't necessarily mean happy like skipping around in a field of daisies and eating chocolate bonbons. I mean happy in a profound sense, awake and alive in the world.
Now, you do mention that we should challenge ourselves with art. We shouldn't necessarily seek out the chocolate bonbons that make us happy, that speak to our endorphins, our pleasure zones. We should find art that is difficult, right?
Yeah, art that disturbs you, that shakes you up, that makes you feel strongly, even if that feeling is in some ways a feeling of revulsion, you're still being woken up to those three realities I talked about earlier. And the more challenged you allow yourselves to be, the more new art and artists you're going to discover that actually do give you pleasure of a more profound kind.
If you're just joining us on Main Street, we're chatting with Bridget Watson Payne, author of the new book that's just out, How Art Can Make You Happy. And Bridget, I want to talk about the format of this book. It's very it's hardbound, it's light, and it's just chock full of goodies. If you're not an expert on art, you can brush up on it. But mainly, just the theme is that, you know, you are the curator, you are the tastemaker, you chart your own journey. So to tell us about this format, how you came about this book in this shape and size.
Yeah, it's really great. I really love the shape, the size, the design, the colors, everything about the way it looks is so pleasing to me. And I think it's a really great example of my publisher, Chronicle Books, sort of matching the form to the content. You know, I wanted to make a book that was unintimidating, that was about happiness, that felt accessible and doable for a really wide range of people. I really believe that art is for everyone, and the fact that they made a book that feels like it's for everyone, that feels accessible. Yellow is such a happy color, and the book is yellow. As you say, it's light. You could throw it in your bag. You could probably almost fit it in your pocket.
Just about, yeah.
I feel like that helps convey the feeling and the message of what I was really trying to say inside the book.
Do you have a favorite passage you'd like to read, Bridget?
Oh, gosh. Let me see if I can find one real
sure.
quick. Hold on. Got it here. You know, I might just start right at the beginning of the introduction.
Sure,
I think that gives us a good sense of what's going on in this book. So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs. Is that good?
Go right ahead. Yep.
Okay. Once upon a time, you loved art, or else you want to discover art now. It's safe to assume that one or the other of those things is true about you, right? Presumably, the reason that you are now reading a book called How Art Can Make You Happy is that you either once had or aspire to have a happy romance with art. Maybe the love went astray, or maybe you can't figure out how to get it off the ground in the first place. Maybe you used to go and look at art in museums and galleries, but you no longer make it a priority. Or maybe you want to do one or the other or both of those things, but are afraid to start. And none of this is making you any happier. It's not as if you intentionally decided, you know what? Art is taking up too much of my time and energy. I'm going to let it go out of my life, and I will feel better, freer. No. You're not living a life that feels diminished by the absence of art in it, but you're also stuck hauling around an unpleasant load of guilt over how you should be having art in your life, but you don't. So what happens when you have coffee with one of your friends who actually does go out to exhibitions and is knowledgeable about artists is that you find yourself doing what guilty people do, bemoaning, making excuses, bemoaning some more, not because your friend cares a bit whether you did or didn't make it out to that latest blockbuster show at the museum, but because you care. You care more than you care to admit, but you don't know how to fix it. And here's the thing. Contrary to the impression you may gather from any number of sources, ranging from the art press to your grandma, art should bring happiness into your life. Let's say that one more time. Art should bring happiness into your life. Is art always happy? No, of course not. No more than it's always pretty or comfortable or easy. But can engaging with art's potent brew of visual pleasure, intellectual rigor, myriad meanings, and unexpected worldviews, make you a happier human being with a profoundly enriched life? Resoundingly, the answer is yes.
A happy romance with art. Speaking of the romantic side, or at least the adventurous side of art that may lead you to who knows what kind of interactions, you mentioned that you might want to have a little extra fun when visiting an art gallery, maybe even going in disguise?
No.
What?
You've hit upon one of the silliest, and I kind of love it. It's one of the funnier parts of the book. So I've talked to a lot of people about art galleries specifically, by which I mean not in a museum, but storefronts that actually sell art. And most art galleries are selling most art for a lot of money, for thousands of dollars, and most people are not shopping for something like that on most days. And so a lot of people I found in, you know, the conversations I had getting ready to write this book felt very intimidated by the idea of going into art galleries just to look. They felt like, oh, the people who work there are going to be unhappy with me that I'm just there to look and not to buy, and I don't really belong in there because I don't have all this money. This is a whole source of anxiety. And first I always just sort of said, well, you do belong in there. The people who work there know that people come in to look all the time. It's completely normal. It's standard. It's not a problem. But still, I found that I was not necessarily convincing people, and I sort of said, okay, worst case scenario, you really want to go extreme. If you really just can't bring yourself to feel comfortable in an art gallery, what you do is you dress up. You dress yourself up as an imaginary rich person. And that does not mean you have to have rich people clothes, because most people don't have, you know, a bunch of designer clothes lying around. What you have is one really nice thing. Whatever the nicest thing you own, be it a piece of jewelry or a jacket or, you know, the shoes that you bought for a job interview, whatever the nicest piece of clothing you have is, you put that on. And actually everything else you wear should be kind of trashed. if you have paint splattered jeans or, you know, torn, you know, the jeans you garden in, you know, just something, because only clearly only somebody who felt totally confident that they belonged in an art gallery would wear torn up jeans in there.
You get away with pauper chic, yes.
Right. Torn up jeans and really nice shoes. You go in there and you just pretend, you just, you know, it's an exercise in playing pretend. You imagine that you do have a big wad of cash in your bag that you could at any moment slap down and buy anything in there if you wanted to. And you just, you know, give yourself an artificial dose of confidence if you don't really feel that confident. And it kind of becomes a silly, you know, an entirely silly exercise just to shake you up and get you out of your sort of normal trepidatious walking in going, oh, I don't know, do I belong here? You know, act like you own the place and see if that gives you, you know, the boost of confidence you need.
And then, for goodness sake, post it to Instagram if you do that. We'd like to see that.
please, with the hashtag, how art can make you happy, please.
Yes,
I would love to see that.
We're starting a movement here in the beautiful state of North Dakota here, Bridget. Well, speaking of art in local places, there's so much art going on in communities across the country, and mural paintings on houses, street art. How can we be good art citizens and support what our creative neighbors are doing?
I think that's a great question. One of the things I talk about in the book is all these alternative ways to look at art. People sort of tend to default to, I need to go to a museum, I need to go to galleries. Not every town has museums and galleries in it, or maybe not many have already gone to them. There are so many other ways to look at art, ranging from, you know, books and the internet in your own home to out in the world. A lot of cities increasingly and towns have programs for public art. So, you know, public art installations and sculptures and that kind of thing placed around town. And as you're saying, there's street art, there's murals, There's so much going on. The internet is a wonderful resource for this sort of thing. If you Google murals or street art and the name of, you know, the town you live in, you can usually find some pretty good resources. There are also some resources I list in the book about, you know, websites that aggregate that kind of information so that you can figure out where to go look and really treat that as art. I think the best way we can support the creative endeavors that our, you know, immediate community members are engaged in is to really go and treat it as art. I think sometimes people, you know, see something on a, up on a wall and they think, oh, did that person have permission to do that? Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Is that graffiti? Is that, a, you know, I don't know, you know, kind of treat it dubiously.
Right.
But if we think that something was really created with artistic intent, then giving it the same respect and acknowledgement that we would, you know, art in a museum is really the best way we can support it.
Looking at art is a great gateway drug to making art. You said that, Bridget. So is there a creative type burning and lurking beneath us?
I think so. I think increasingly people have come to acknowledge the connection between making art or having a creative outlet and happiness. That there sort of was, for many years, the stereotype of the tortured artist that, you know, making art actually made you miserable. But the real experience of people seems to be that, by and large, it actually, you know, does make you happier. And that a lot of people, again, have some of the same doubts, guilt, and anxiety about making art that they have about looking at art, that they're feeling like, is this really for them? Are they talented enough? Is this something for other people? They're not sure. You know, and then giving yourself that creative license, that permission to just do something and not worry about, you know, it doesn't have to be good. It just has to be. You know, and that starting to look at art can be a way to encourage yourself down that path.
And last question, Bridget, and it's a burning one. How can I'm dying to know this. How can I credibly talk about art at a cocktail party?
So this is another one of those things that, you know, almost everything in this book came up in conversations with people and sort of uncovering what people's anxieties were and what some of my own anxieties were as well. And I think there's a perception when you're talking to people, especially if you're in a group of people that you perceive as being smart or cultured, that they know so much more than you do. The person you're talking to at a party must know so much more about art than you do. And I think art is a great topic of conversation, especially with people you don't know that well, because it gets you away from the boring small talk that we've all had a million times. It lets you get to know somebody. It gets you get to discover new artists that you might not have heard of before because they're going to share, you know, what they like with you. It's a fantastic way to have conversations. And I think one way to keep it from being daunting and intimidating is to always work for an assumption of equality. Assume a level playing field. Assume you both, you know, may know different things, may care about different things, but that you are, it's a conversation of equals. The one thing that if you do get the sense that someone knows more than you, it's quite likely that the main thing they know that you don't know is that they've gotten pretty good at name dropping, that they've learned the names of some of their favorite artists and they can drop them into the conversation. And that, you know, immediately makes someone sound knowledgeable because they are rattling off, you know, the names of these various people. But learning the names of our favorite artists and being able, it doesn't have to be a huge number either, but just being able to say, I like so-and-so's work, you know, really gives us, again, that conversational confidence to engage, you know, with people in that way.
We're social creatures. Art is very social, for sure. Bridget Watson Payne is the author of several books, including The Secret Art of Being a Grown-Up, New York Jackie, about Jackie Kennedy Onassis, I'm guessing, right?
Yes.
Yep. And the new one we've been talking about today out on Chronicle Books, How Art Can Make You Happy. Bridget, real fun talking to you about your book here on Main Street. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Main Street's Eric Dethridge talking with author Bridget Watson Payne. You can find more information about her at Bridget Watson Payne, Payne is spelled PAYNE.com. Decoded 8 Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Fort Union Trading Post National Historic Site, featuring the stories and archaeological artifacts that help us discover and understand the region's native peoples, wildlife, and landscape. Unearth the past, discover today. West of Williston on Highway 1804. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant at the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck, naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Decoded 8 Book for May 3rd. As the 20th century arrived, women's clothing was lavish and cumbersome. Madame Gauche Charat, designed a new corset in 1900. She thought the corsets of the 19th century were not healthy, and she was right. They restricted breathing and often caused fainting. They even caused misshapen ribs and internal organs. The newly designed health corset removed pressure from the waist and diaphragm, but pushed the bosom forward and the hips back, so it wasn't much of an improvement. Women topped the corset with as much as 40 pounds of clothing, including frilly blouses, petticoats, and heavy skirts. The fashionable woman required an extensive wardrobe. There were morning dresses, afternoon dresses, tea dresses, and evening gowns. Upper-class women changed clothes many times each day. The simplest trip meant traveling with trunks to accommodate corsets, crinolines, dresses, skirts, blouses, and shoes. The working-class woman did not have as many changes of clothing and usually wore dresses made of muslin. She would dampen her skin with water before putting on the muslin dress. The garment would stick to her skin and emphasize her figure. But in colder climates, women who followed this trend sometimes died of pneumonia. Crinolines were heavy undergarments made of horsehair and steel, worn so a skirt would keep its shape. It made ordinary tasks like walking through a doorway or sitting on a chair almost impossible. In 1861, the wife of poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow died when her skirt, held out by crinoline, got too close to the fireplace and caught fire. On this date in 1900, the Griggs Courier of North Dakota reported a similar accident. Clara Wilson was driving in a carriage with her daughter. When the carriage had stopped, Clara stepped out upon a discarded match. Her skirt caught fire. Bystanders did their best to put out the fire, but she was badly burned and died later that day. In the early 1900s, women's fashions began to change as women became more active. One reason for the change was the bicycle, which quickly became popular. Although women were warned about health problems caused by being too active, they took to the bicycle, which gave rise to less restrictive and less deadly fashion trends. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Writer Hala Alian knows what it's like to be from a family displaced by war.
I definitely think that there's an intergenerational trauma that went along with losing a homeland that you see trickle down through the different generations.
Her debut novel, Salt Houses, follows a Palestinian family uprooted in 1967 to modern day. Plus, we'll have the latest on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, it's been a century since World War I. Now a little-known story of that war comes to us from author Robert Gowdy. It's a compelling tale about the first fully integrated army of modern times. The title, African Kaiser, General Paul von Leto Vorbeck, and the Great War in Africa. It's a true account about an unorthodox and undefeated German general. Also tomorrow, Chef Tim Rosendahl will be here with this week's food topic. It's pastrami. And Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.